I think I can go. Good morning. I already got the sign here that I'm already on. Well, welcome, friends of the middleware. My name is Clemens. I work at Microsoft as a technical lead on the Windows Azure App Fabric team. I work mostly on Service Bus. And so I'm going to be talking today about my product. There's two sessions about Service Bus today. One is kind of the outside perspective of applied sciences. Done later by Christian Weyer, and I'm going to go and talk to you about Service Bus, and I have a little bit of a difficult job here. Not that I'm wanting any sympathy for it, but we have TechEd US, or sorry, North America, in 3 weeks. We will present some brand new things at TechEd US in 3 weeks, so now I have the grand challenge of telling you about it without telling you about it. So we'll see how that goes. And I also realize that there are some people in the room who are hungry for new information and because they've been using Service Bus for a while. So I've been thinking about what I can do to please you. So I pulled out the Wireshark. And so we're going to take a look a little bit at some details as we go along, as I show you some demos. So I'm going to show you the simpler demos for everybody, and then for the people who already know it, I'm going to give you a little bit of new information because we're going to take a little bit of a look at the magic that Service Bus performs to do what it does. So, it's PowerPoint. The cloud is a wonderful thing, and all apps will move to the cloud. Everything will move to the cloud. Right? No. What we've done kind of in the last 10, 15 years is we've created this interconnected web of apps. We have, so this is a picture kind of leaning on the Microsoft internal network. Microsoft operates one of the largest intranets in the world with thousands of apps. And in large enterprises, it's not rare to have literally thousands, 6,000 apps, 8,000 apps, 10,000 apps that serve all kinds of different businesses. So there's a survey that Microsoft conducted a few years ago with the largest enterprise customers, and thousands of different applications was not rare. So I just have a snippet here, and these are all different kinds of apps, and every company now has a CRM, and everybody has an ERP, or many ERPs, HR systems, and then internal marketplaces where you can go and buy things as an employee for your department, and that goes out to all kinds of different vendors. The vendors do the fulfillment for it, and you get status reported back into your wonderful portal. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's just interconnected inside the enterprise. And as we get a cost push towards cloud computing, where very many enterprises say, I don't want to go and have the cost on my books for hardware and also software for non-essential systems or systems that I only need occasionally or that are seasonal, then the push to the cloud becomes a very interesting one from a cost perspective. So very many enterprises, for instance, have seasonal apps. When you think about processes like the annual employee satisfaction poll, or you think about the applications for your daily, for your yearly tax statements, these are things which are seasonal and they get a peak where people need to work with them or review periods. People need to work with them for a short period of time, and everybody needs to work on them, and then you can basically just fold them away and not run them, or run them on very minimal hardware. So you have two machines that you need to have throughout the year, and then all of a sudden you need 50 for 3 weeks. That's something that's ideal for cloud computing because you don't need to provision those machines. You don't need to care about them. You just make your app in a way that it can run in a public cloud, and then you just go and rent the capacity for 2 weeks, and then just go and potentially even scale back to machines you have on-premise. So it's really interesting for a lot of applications that aren't in the enterprise that are kind of in these categories, especially stuff that has to do with campaigns, especially stuff that's easily outsourced. where you can go and either go to a SaaS vendor or where you can go and just make it yourself but then host it out in the cloud. So all of a sudden, you have things that live up in public cloud space outside of the firewall, and you have things that sit that remain inside of the firewall, but these tethers are still the same. The connections are still the same. So when you kind of lift an app up, that's kind of like stepping into a gum and then pulling up your feet, so you get all this stuff hanging off it. So all these connections are still there. Now mind that many of those connections are something that you just can't cover easily with technologies like VPN, especially not in scenarios where you're really starting to outsource to an external SaaS vendor or where this external application is shared across multiple sites. A VPN solution, and that's true for Windows Azure Connect as much as it's true for the solutions offered by Amazon, for instance, is existing so that you can take an internal application and expand that internal application's reach or scale by adding machines to your network. So effectively, you walk up to the cloud and you rake machines from there into your network and you extend that scope of your app. That's what those solutions are for. But if you truly have a loosely coupled SOA-oriented, services-oriented app, SOA, I use SOA loosely. For me, SOA doesn't mean soap, it also means rest. If you have an application that really interacts and integrates on an endpoint-to-endpoint basis with multiple parties, then a VPN solution is not necessarily the best one. If we think about this as a sourced vendor market, so it's a vendor market in the sense that it's an internal market where you have where the company, the enterprise, has vendors that supply services and goods for it, but then that market is actually provided by another yet another party. Then you have this multi-tenant marketplace, and that multi-tenant marketplace now needs to talk to the vendors up and needs to talk to multiple enterprises down. If you have a scenario that, like that, then again, the VPN doesn't get you any further because you can't create a trust domain around all these enterprises, right? VPN, level 2 network integration, what that means is you trust everything that sits in that network. So you can't do that. A wonderful example for that kind of integration on a slightly less complicated scale, but in terms of systems involved, but on a very interesting scale in terms of numbers, is with franchise companies, or franchise companies really, in, for instance, the fast food industry. So we have a wonderful use case that we talked through with one of those larger companies in the U.S. Who had a really interesting problem with a VPN kind of solution, where they had a head office HQ system and then had all their franchise restaurants connected with machines that are owned by those restaurants. Remember, these are independently operated businesses. And they were linked in with VPN to their network. Those machines were, everybody could play with them and everybody could get on them. And so you had a bunch of 18-year-old people go and stick USB sticks into those machines and putting all kinds of stuff on them. So they found the problem that they had now to defend everybody from everybody's worms because they created a common trust zone across all those machines. So really for all these cases, for all the things that we have all together done in the last 10 years, is we have tried to go and integrate services in a SOA style. We've tried to build service-oriented architecture. We've tried to integrate services. We clean separations. And we want to go and interconnect services. So that's a thing that's really difficult, and that's kind of the mission that we have with Service Bus, to make this here possible so that you can take a service, you can move it out to the cloud, or you just move it to a different site, and it doesn't need to be the Azure cloud, it doesn't need to be the Amazon cloud, just is off-site. How do we solve that problem of endpoint federation between apps in the presence of firewall and NAT and different security boundaries? That's the core job that we have in Service Bus, plus a few new missions that I'm going to talk about later. So There's no mutual trust between those systems, right? They sit behind firewall and NAT. And they are not built, so this thing which we move out, which you lift out of this federation of applications, it's not necessarily built for being talked to by external services. So we have a wonderful example also that I should mention in this context. So let me go flip back. Airline in the UK. What they've done is they have figured out what is our cloud strategy, and they did that 3 years ago, EasyJet. And what they did is they said, you know, sat down on the green on the blank slate and said, what is our cloud strategy? Because we need to have this, because EasyJet is a technology company first and an airline second. Their belief is that they can drive down cost and be more efficient through technology. And it's secondary that they have airplanes that bring the revenue. They want to make it as efficient as possible to run a business, and then they happen to be in the airline business. That's kind of their stance on that. So they know that cloud computing is something for them. So what they've done is do an analysis of how to use cloud computing. What they came out with first, the initial strategy was, we go very conservative, commodity, and then line of business, secondary functions, and then critical business functions, and then airside. Airside means really stuff that has to do with airplanes. That was their strategy, right? We start with a commodity. We start backup. And then they came around and started looking at the platform that we had and actually went exactly the opposite side. They started airside. So what they realized is they could save a lot of money by not checking in customers through the systems provided at the airports, but leveraging EasyJet.com and the back-end services behind that to check in customers. Because they already know how to create the passenger manifests and the load manifests and all the manifests that they need, because their system does that. So they said, there's no point that we rent for expensive money all these green screen terminals at the airports, which are really hard to handle and cause a lot of long lines because they're just inefficient. But rather, let's go and build some efficient devices and that are optimized for our flow, and then let's go and use our backend systems. But their backend systems, like here, were not built for that public consumption. They were not built to be exposed on the edge of their own data center. So what they said is they looked at service bus and said, wow, all of our services that we have are WCF already. I only need to go and change the config, and I automatically get a security shield on top of it provided by the access control service. And so that's something I don't need to worry about anymore. So that's what they did. And so exposing those backend services out to a place where the devices could talk to it took them a day. And that's something that they did cost analysis, and it was enormous savings. Because exposing a service out on your edge is actually very expensive. And if you want to make it work through a standard protocol with a predictable port, it's even more expensive or close to impossible, because you either need to have a very powerful demultiplexer that sits up there, which you can't readily buy, or you need to have a huge number of IP addresses, which you can't buy. So that's an interesting case here too. So that's the first picture that I have, right? That's the EasyJet picture. We have a number of other cases where people just have generally a last mile issue, where you have software services sitting behind NATs and firewalls, and you want to get to those services, but you have obstacles in getting there. I'll give you some abstract examples. There's companies which are currently building smart grids, electricity smart grids. Electricity, it's basically on use scale. Every consumer gets in their house some device which is helping saving energy and controlling charging expensive devices. Very many energy companies, especially in the United States right now, because there's a huge push for it, are slightly afraid of the electric car. Because imagine that, all the cars that are in the street, if they were all electric, plug-in electric, what would happen? All of a sudden, the electricity grid becomes the fuel station for everybody. The grid hasn't been built for that purpose. So there's a lot of capacity that would move from tanks to the wires. So that kind of energy consumption needs to be managed, and the way it's being managed, and there's multiple approaches, but one of them is take a pricing signal, a price signal of how much the energy costs at a certain point in time, and basically shine a cone of low energy prices, relatively low energy prices, over an area. And so you put your car into the garage, you plug it in, it doesn't charge yet. Once the low price comes around, you start charging your car, and then that lasts for 2 hours, and then the price goes up again, and you define your threshold when you want to go and charge your car. To do that, that device needs to be able to go and get some data. So how do you push that data into those devices? That's one thing. People want to go and get at their media, right? And there's multiple ways, and every single one of those ways involves a relay. You have a service that sits somewhere on your PC, on your home server somewhere, and you want to go and walk up and get some music or some video that you have stored there. How do you get through that? Well, in the simplest way, as we all, as technologists, would say, hey, well, I have a router, and I go and open that port, and then I can go through that port. That's simple. If you have enough skills, if you can do that and would do that to someone else's router that you have otherwise no relationship to, but most importantly, if you have a public IP address, which in many cases, in many parts of the world, people don't have anymore. In the U.S., one of the things that's starting to come up, especially in rural areas, is WiMAX, and that's also getting foothold in rural areas around the world, or just UMTS 3G connectivity. And once you're on one of those wireless networks, you don't have a public IP address anymore, which means you can do whatever you want, you don't get that traffic. So how do you expose a service that has your music, and how do you get to it? All of a sudden, you need to have something that helps you with that. So Service Bus, the mission of Service Bus is to provide that functionality, connectivity, the service relay, and also capabilities, and we do that through samples mostly, things we give on top of this, like protocol tunneling. You have a SQL server, and the SQL server sits on site, and you have an application that sits in the cloud, and you don't want to go and talk to that SQL server as a matter of course all the time, but you have an application that goes and runs in the cloud, it works against SQL, Azure, and then as you complete work, you need to run one transaction on your on-premise SQL server. So would it be nice if you could go and just have a SQL client sitting up in the cloud that just talks straight up to the TDS, to the database that sits on site? For many cases, that would be very sufficient. You don't need to build a service around it. You just want to call the store procedure and just pass two or three parameters. So for that, you need to have a tunnel. But there's other cases where you want to go and just take control of a machine over an existing protocol, let's say RDP. Where you want to go and tunnel into a machine and you have a pre-existing protocol and you just want to get there. But you need to have a way to go and find that machine. So that's what tunneling is. We have a sample. I'm going to point you to it on my blog that you can download for that purpose. The other thing we do is messaging. And we have currently a capability in this product, in the shipping product, called the message buffer. And the message buffer, I'll be elaborating a little more about that, is a little queue-like thing that you can put messages in, and you can go and get messages out. And that's very useful for online-offline capabilities, and it's also very interoperable because it's a simple REST service. So that's the core things that we currently have. In the longer run, what we're also going to do is service management and discovery and monitoring. Today, Service Bus is, and you're also going to see that, Service Bus has a namespace set of feeds. So you walk up to Service Bus, you provision a namespace. Once you provision a namespace, you get a feed, and you get actually a cascading hierarchy of feeds. And so with that, you can walk that hierarchy, and you can go and discover services that exist in your namespaces. That's a very basic discovery capability. We will add queryability to this. And we will add monitorability to this. So you will be able eventually to go and peek at a queue and see the throughput statistics. You'll be able to see connection points, and you're going to be seeing all the sessions that are going on. You'll be able to shoot down sessions individually. So we're building this out into a monitorable fabric for managing all communications. So that's in the future, but that's part of the mission. And then we're also going to have integration, routing, coordination, transformation. Part of our greater team, the greater Service Bus team, is also the BizTalk team. BizTalk is building BizTalk Server as a product, and that BizTalk Server product exists and remains. But those guys are now taking pieces of BizTalk and those pieces which we can make scale and are moving those into Service Bus. So you're going to see that happen over the course of the year. And the way you should think about this is you have a connection point, as we call them, so a relay thing, you're going to see that in detail, or a queue, or a topic, you're going to see that too, what that means, and you can go and apply aspects on those. So you can apply an aspect on the ingress, you can apply an aspect on the egress. That aspect is a pipeline, and that pipeline can have a schema to validate, it can have an extraction in form of an XSLT that goes and then transforms, and then also sets properties on messages so that we can go and then route. So that's called VITR, and as a pattern. And so we're going to have those capabilities that sit in Service Bus, and you'll be able to declaratively add them to the system so that we get some of the key capabilities of BizTalk into Service Bus and have a really nice composable architecture for all those pieces. So that's the mission that we have. That's kind of our charter that we execute on for the next 2 years. So the first thing I want to talk about is the connectivity relay. And I'm going to show you a bunch of examples around that. The first thing to note is all the wonderful, colorful dots that we have up there. Service Bus is first and foremost, like as the most fundamental thing, it's a naming fabric. So you go to to the portal and you create a namespace. So let's go and I'm going to start myself an IE. I was getting nervous for a moment here. And I'm going to go into the in private browsing mode, the how Hanselman calls it, the buy your wife a gift mode. And I go to windows.azure.com. What do you think what that is? So windows.azure.com is the address of our portal. And now, unlike you, I'm going to use a different kind of Windows Live ID. So that shows all the beauty of Federation. Because it turns out that's all built with the help of the Federation capabilities that we have. This is federating through ADFS. Because we sign in to Windows Azure with our Microsoft ID. So I'm now getting redirected to the Microsoft STS, which is doing very thorough work. It is thinking very hard whether it wants to talk to me. If it doesn't, I would be sorely disappointed because we have proper network. Come on. You can't be serious about this. All right. Well, the thing I wanted to show. So I'm going to go to Lapse because Lapse is a little snappier. This is the Microsoft STS being asleep. It's night in the U.S., so I can kind of understand that the system is a little. So the thing I want to show you is the following: you go into Service Bus here in the portal, and so the production experience looks exactly like this. And don't infer anything from what you just saw about the STS, right? That's just our own problem. You're not going to see this. Windows Live ID works just fine. And I can go and create a new namespace. And here I'm going to call this Clemens V9, and check whether that's available. It's available. I'm lucky. And I'm going to go and create that. What I'm doing now with this step is I'm creating a brand new namespace for myself. And you can create virtually as many as you like within the scope of your subscription. In fact, it's gated at 50. And with that, you create a brand new scope for naming, for projecting things in. The result of that is, and we're seeing this activating, the activation here, what that does is now it goes and creates rules in the access control service, and it also goes and sets up DNS. So this is going to be available shortly. So in the meantime, we're just going to go and look at, it came around. Finally, good morning, Microsoft. Great, because we're going to need that later. So I can now go to my namespace, and the namespace here, if you go and take a look at this wonderful portal, has the service gateway here. So we're going to go and get that and go to my namespace root, and you'll see nothing happens. That's not good. Well, they might be doing an update. Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, that fills me with great happiness. All right, let's go use the real one. That's okay. So here's the production system. I don't know what happened right there. Luckily, I'm going against production with the demo. So what this here represents is my namespace feed. If you go and take a look at this, there's nothing in there, but it's just an Atom feed that you're getting. And once we project services into that Atom feed, you can go and discover them, so you can go and traverse that namespace. Every name that can ever exist in that namespace already exists. As proof, I'm going to go to /foo/bar/baz/buzz, and I get a feed. So all the names that could ever exist already exist. And you can now go into that fabric, and you can go and put stuff into those names. And putting stuff into those names means you create a thing like a message buffer or a connection point or a queue or a topic and more things in the future. You just place them into your naming fabric, which gives them a stable place in the world. All right? So what I'm going to do in a moment is I'm going to go and project a service, an HTTP service, into one of those names. There's some implicit interaction happening in the current model where if you open up a listener into that name, we flow a policy up into the service which creates a so-called volatile connection point that you then go and listen on. But you get this naming fabric, it's a tree, all the names that can exist already exist, and you can go and then put artifacts into that structure. So that's a very important basic notion that you should be aware of. So then a receiver comes up and makes an outbound call, and it says, I want to listen on this name. And the message that flows, so there's a connection being made, and that connection is being made on port 9351 usually, says, I want to register that name. So it registers that name, and now the naming fabric that sits in Service Bus knows that there's something there. It also knows that it sits on the machine where you see the arrow pointing to. Now, a client wants to go and talk to that machine. So what it does, what the sender does is the sender just walks up to that name in Service Bus, clemens.servicebus.windows.net/echo, to a machine, right? That machine, that's where it just came from, and creates an outbound socket. It says, hey, I want to go and talk. I want to create a session with this guy. As a result, we're sending a message, a control message up. That's a little distorted. We're sending a... Really? PowerPoint let me down. Astonishing. So we're sending a control message up. The control message is then routed into the system towards the right node and to the right machine, and then comes down to the receiver. And the receiver will now go and rendezvous with that forwarder on the node where the client came in. And once we've done this, we're creating a byte, effectively just a byte stream forwarder, which goes and pumps the socket back and forth between the two places. So at that point, no serialization happens between the places, and we go as fast as we can. There's an additional option here that we can turn on, where we can go and negotiate a direct connection between those two places if possible. So we do an analysis. If you turn this mode on, I'm going to show you that in a moment, we are going to go and negotiate whether those two machines can see each other directly. If so, we're going to go and create a socket between them directly. Or if they can't see each other directly, we're doing a 50-50, or in quiet NATs, 80-20, attempt to go and create them directly using a NAT traversal algorithm that we have. I can probably explain it once I've showed the details of that. So, basics is using outbound connections only. You don't need to have any open firewall and NAT ports, and the outbound connections all are using TCP. So I have a sample. I have two samples I'm going to show. I already showed one of them earlier in the other session. So let's go and go back to that and run that first. That's the image sample. And the image sample is very simple. It's just a WCF service. It's using the service namespace, Clemens Sandbox, creating a service URI where that's being hosted. In that namespace, call that image. The result of that function here is HTTPS Clemens Sandbox .servicebus.windows.net/image. That's where that's going to be hosted. That's the base address for that service. So if I go and run this, so this has a very simple web get contract, right? It's just returning an image. While this starts, I can go and show that to you. So here's the image contract. This is going to make Glenn partially happy because it's the current state, the shipping state of affairs of the thing that he owns. And there's an image service, and that's very simple. It just has a bitmap, and then just returns a stream and sets the content type. And Glenn has made all kinds of magic that makes this line be just half a line, I think. You don't have to return the image anymore. That's what I thought. You just hint at the image with meth. So the address that we have here is, you just use meth, and then you hold meth over the service, and just knows that the image is there. So this address, if you were equipped with network, you could go and hit that now, and you would get the founders or the first folks that work at Microsoft. I'm going to go and mark all this. Hanselman knows all these shortcuts to do all this like with a single a click. So there's apparently some Windows blah shortcut how I can exactly select this line, and I can just do one click and then put it on the clipboard. It's astonishing. Yes, so let's go and get that just quickly. So that's the image. It's not the image because I modified that sample, right? Yes, I did. So what you see is 401, the request contains no authorization header. That's not good. Well, I have a service that I exposed, and I exposed that through this, the binding, the web HTTP relay binding. Right? Glenn owns the web HTTP binding. We own the web HTTP relay binding. And so we listen on service bus. So this is a regular service, and the service as configured, at least with the piece you see here, let's hide that, would just be normal get service, and you would usually be able to get that image straight away. But we're overlaying this with the access control service. It's automatically on by default, so you can't get at that image without bringing a token from the access control service. So how do we turn that off for the purposes of the demo? Because we're not going to go into all the details of the magic of acquisition of tokens here. You can see that in the samples. I'm going to say relay authentication type none. So now I can start that again. And what I've done now is I've opted out of the integration with the access control service. I basically say, no, no, this service is fine. I will take anonymous traffic into that service. So it's starting, and as it's starting, it's now available again. I can go and hit F5, and we'll now get, I'm saying I'm getting that image. And if I say I'm getting that image, I'm getting that image. And if you don't want that, you want that, my friend. There we go. So that just came. So I'm hitting a public web service endpoint, mine in San Antonio, Texas, right? And now that's all coming back to me here to talk to me. That's well, I route some of the TV that way. So this was HTTP, and HTTP does a little bit of that dance. So we're going to go and take another sample, and that's the standard echo sample. That's the thing we always use for most of the demos. So I'm using that also for Sandbox. And the echo sample is very simple. Just going to run the wonder whether I've set up the client. That would be tragic if I didn't. Yes, I have. So let's go and run the service. And then we're going to go and I'm such a lazy boy. So that comes up. The initial handshake is somewhat constrained mostly by latency. There it comes. And by loading some stuff. So this setup is also fairly simple. So I have a server. That service is exposed as an echo client, echo server, echo client. It runs over SOAP, and it's using the net TCP relay binding. So we're going to go and so this is the sample as it works. We're going to take a look at that, and I'm going to do some modifications, and I'm going to show you some things too. So we'll mostly focus on the server side here because you've seen the client side, and so that's not all that interesting. So the first thing you'll notice here is that we create a transport client endpoint behavior. That's the behavior where we stuff all the special service bus things in. And we need to have a credential. The credential is a shared secret, and the shared secret has an issuer name and an issuer secret. Think of that as username and password. And those are credentials that are set up with ACS. So in ACS, there's a notion of a service identity, and that service identity is here. There's a standard service identity that's being set up called owner for each namespace, and that has a key. Using the ACS management API, you can make more, and you can create rules for who can talk to that namespace, and you can create relying parties, as they call them in ACS, that overlay effectively your namespace. So you can have a service bus service that sits at Echo, and you can go create a matching relying party in ACS that has this relying party URI / Echo and can create dedicated rules for this. So you can go using ACS, you can secure all those things. I'm currently working on a sample to actually make that tangible for folks like you, because that duality of service bus and access control tends to be a little difficult. So I'm currently writing a super simple API specifically for our new queues and topics, which will also work for these things here, that allows you to create a simple identity and then simply just specify rules as if they were an access control list, an ACL. I'm working on that. I hope I will have that ready by TechEd. So otherwise, we're looking at the clients here. So I'm creating a channel factory. Referencing the relay endpoint binding, which we're going to see in a moment. I'm adding this credential, creating the channel open, I have a client. On the server side, I go and create the service URI. The name here is SB. That's the way how we name those endpoints. Same dance here with the credentials. I create a service host, and then I'm adding to the endpoint I'm configuring config, the service registry settings and this credential. Now the service registry settings basically say whether the service is published publicly visible, so if people can discover this without bringing a token to the registry. So the effect of that is, so let's go and run that again, is that in the sandbox namespace, there's one. Climate sandbox, service-bus.windows.net. This thing now shows up. If you bring an ACS token, so you need to go and acquire a token from ACS, that's all explained in the samples. If you bring that token to this GET request, you always see all the services that exist. If you set discovery to public explicitly, then you also see it if you don't bring a token, so that's a feature for demoability. But also, if you just want to enable people to go and see those services in this feed. So that's a way to use this as a feed to dispatch to other feeds, which may be sitting in different places. The interesting thing here is if you host a RSS feed at the tail end of this, you have a seamless experience from going from our feed into the feed you project in there. So you can create a feed of feeds very easily with that mechanism. So that's the discovery you can go and turn on. So that's very interesting. Another thing that we have here in the sample is something that is done up here, taking a parameter for that app. Let me go and stop it again. Well, we can take a parameter for that application that sets the connectivity mode. That is the most interesting and important weapon that we have in the arsenal for NAT and firewall traversal. If you have services that sit inside of the firewall and they can't get out because the outbound TCP ports are blocked, and that's true for many enterprise environments, there's only one way around this, and that is HTTP. So you got to get out, you got to be able to get out on HTTP. So the standard way how we get out is on port 9351. So I'll show you what happens if you go and sit on the standard connectivity mode. So we're going to go force a mode. So we're going to say connectivity mode is TCP. All right. And to demonstrate this, I'm going to go and capture this all with one of our favorite tools right here. All right. And we're really interested in destinations that go to the data center. And we're on 70. I'm not hitting anything with 70, so I don't go more precise than that. The destination port is 9351. I know that. So I go and run the service. And we'll see data coming by. And this is just the outbound connection information. If I go and follow the stream here, you'll see that goes to, it's a net under the covers, it's net TCP, Clemens sandbox, servicebus.windows.net, 9351, echo service. And then, so what you're seeing here is the net framing protocol. And then you see the magic application SSL TLS, and there's a certificate. And from here, it's all garbage. Right? So this is still the cert. And then as you scroll further down, that's all encrypted. Well, it's starting to be encrypted data starting here. So this is the SSL handshake that happens in the beginning, and then it's all binary. So let's say port 9351 is not open. What are we going to do then? Well, let's go and stop that capture, and let's stop that service again, and let's force a different mode. And we also have auto. And auto-detect basically selects between those modes dynamically and even at runtime. So if you get disconnected, we reconnect. And if the network environment changes between those reconnects, we do a reprobing of seeing what the network infrastructure looks like. I'm going to force that other mode, though. I'm going to say HTTP. And what HTTP does now is it's forcing that all through HTTP. So we're going to use the same filter that I just had. I'm going to say interfaces start. So we're going to capture again.
And now I'm going to go this way using HTTP. And what you'll see is that Wireshark stays quiet, but eventually we're going to see that showing up because this goes all to port 80. So now the magic what appears here is you can go and follow, if you follow the stream, we go and do a post, a constructor post, as we call it, to the Echo service over there. So it's an HTTP service, purely port 80, and that sends us two rendezvous endpoints on the same machine that we go to. So that's a little kind of secret. And then if we follow that here, oh, that's still the construction call. There's a post. We haven't seen much data yet. And there should also be a matching get. That's still the post. Let's see. Are we online yet? Yes, we are. Where's the get? Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm looking at the stream. Yes. So, thank you very much. So, and that's the matching get. So what you see is a set of streams. One is a long get and one is a long post, and they run as application octet stream in both directions. What we then do, if you go and follow those, odd things happen. You see the same protocol with a little bit of padding over in there that you just saw on TCP happening over here, and you only see half of it. So what we do is we take this pair of get and post, and then we overlay that with SSL, and then we put the NetTCP protocol over it and plumb that under the existing NetTCP infrastructure, and that's how we get out. So we're being very aggressive about really coming through any network environment and see the cloud, and that's where the listener sits, and that's where you get in. So we're not defeating anything in the firewalls. This is all transparent what we do, right? And if you want to block us, you can block us because you can see what we're doing here, and it's explicitly port 80 so that you can't. So that was that. So another mode that we have is, and that's in the binding. So I'll go over here, and we're using the standard NetTCP relay binding, right here. The NetTCP relay binding, if I was rewriting this, I'm not going to go and change the sample completely, but I'm just going to show you that in here. So I can go and create a NetTCP relay binding object straight away. And this has so we're going to go to create it here. That has a particular connection mode. And that connection mode may be relayed, which is the default, or hybrid, which is a special mode. Hybrid is interesting because it does wonders for your latency. And that's what I said before, what we tried to do with a direct connection. And I said I would explain that, so I'm going to. Even though it's only an approximation, what I'm going to say. So we have the service in the cloud, and you have two services, and they're already connected. So they're already talking. So there's a socket that exists. It goes through the relay, just as I showed on that slide. Right? So now, because they're both in hybrid, as they made the connection, as the connection snaps, both of them send probing packets to two endpoints on 9353 and 9354. You can also observe that using Wireshark if you want to. So, and those packets are sent effectively at the same time. The reason why we need two ports and send them at the same time is because we want to force the NAT device that sits on the path to basically open two ports, because that's what happens, right? NAT automatically maps a port. And we send that up to the cloud service. We look down on those packets and we have two ports on the NAT device which is opened. And typically they're going to be consecutive. So you have 32,520, 32,521. That means that the next open port that would come out is likely the next number for a few milliseconds. I mean, until the next guy comes out with a new connection. So it's a speculative thing. So we sent those two packets. As soon as we know, we tell the other guy, basically on the reply. That gives both parties enough information to then try a trick. They're both trying to do an outbound connect to the predicted other port that's going to be opening. And since SYN packets don't have directionality, so both parties do that connection, we speculate that those two packets actually cross each other on the wire, and if they do, they snap a socket. Even though there's firewalls and nets involved. So with that, we get a direct socket between those two parties, even though they're behind nets and firewalls. And what we then do is we drain the existing connections of the relay. So there's bytes sitting in those buffers everywhere. So we drain that out and move all the new traffic onto that socket. And with that, we get a clean upgrade to that direct socket connection. All that magic is called hybrid. That magic is called hybrid because we always start out in relayed mode and then switch you to a direct connection. You can observe this happening if you go and add another behavior. So there's these behaviors you can go, and there's another thing we have, and that's the connection status behavior. All the things that you didn't see, I told you, you're going to learn some things. Even the people. So a connection status behavior has a wonderful function called online, me and my typing. Hanselman calls this thing the Anders operator. I find that really funny. So you can see there's the connection status behavior that tells you when a connection is online or offline, and then also it will tell you. That's not true. There's the hybrid connection status that you can get. So this is the connection status behavior, how you can see whether a connection is online or offline. And then there's the hybrid connection status. And the hybrid connection status you can get out of the channel properties. So that's something you would have to add yourself as a behavior. And as you are writing a behavior on the channel dispatcher, is a property, and you can get that out as a property. Sorry for confusing you. I may have a sample. Let's see. See, sometimes I get confused by my own features. Let's go. Let's see whether we can show that. Direct CS, direct connection sample. No. See, I haven't even converted that yet. But that's okay. That's okay. So that's the sample that has that all set up. It's a direct connection sample. And the direct connection sample should, if I have that right, there's the hybrid connection status. So that gets out of the channel, you create out of the factory. And you can also do the same thing on the server side. Get this hybrid connection status property. And once connection state changed, that's when the hybrid connection has happened. You can't do that completely quietly. So there's traffic that needs to flow because that whole upgrade mechanism is traffic driven. But if you want to have those connections and you don't want to go and have this all running through the relay accruing charges on service bus, you can try that and simply go and have a little bit of traffic going on that will drive this upgrade and then start actually going with real traffic once you get the signal of upgrading. So that's perfectly reasonable because we have two vectors that we charge. We charge for connection time, and that's where we charge for the listener. So it's not completely free, and there's a second vector where we charge for bandwidth that goes through the system. So you can actually go and avoid that charge for bandwidth if you go hybrid, but be warned, it's not working all under all circumstances. So you always have the fallback option for the relay. So that's a number of options you have in that world, and that will go and do and enable that dance. Is also very fun to look at. So that's the connectivity relay capability. What people are doing with it is all, we have all kinds of things. Christian is going to have in his talk some examples, some more examples of eventing. He's going to show the net event relay binding, I believe. So eventing is one of those things where we see quite a bit of usage. You have an application that sits in Windows Azure and you want to see what's going on right now. One way to do this is there's a sample that's also in the SDK called the Cloud Trace Listener. The Cloud Trace Listener is a piece that you can hook up into system diagnostics as a listener, and all the trace events that are being spewed out go to a publish point on Service Bus that you can then put a listener on, one, two, three, many, and every event that goes in there is fed to all the listeners that sit up there. So it's a direct pub-sub mechanism. It's not a pub-sub mechanism in a decoupled sense, but it's a coupled, means direct connection pub-sub mechanism. But you can push one event, and then it goes to multiple sources with that. So eventing is one of those patterns that we see quite a bit. I'm going to talk about eventing in a little bit more. Service remoting is the other one. That's the initial scenario that I talked about. You have multiple services that are sitting in all kinds of different places. One is hosted, one is in-house, one is outsourced. And you want to go and interconnect them, classic SOA scenario, and you want to go and federate all those endpoints without necessarily trusting the network. For that, it's ideal. You can go and simply create a service, configure it to listen on the relay instead of listening locally. You don't have to expose them through the firewall in any way, and you can leverage that capability straight here. And then tunneling is a capability, how you can go and tunnel arbitrary protocol. Tunneling arbitrary protocol, you might make a note of that. I'm going to go to... Hanselman always goes to Google. I don't. Just saying. Hanselman made so much fun of me yesterday. He's getting it all back. So there's a sample called Portbridge. So if you just search for my last name and Portbridge, you end up at this entry. And what that does is effectively creates an agent, create a service. The service has a TCP client. The agent has a TCP listener. And you can go and basically point the service at any TCP endpoint or name pipe that service can't see, so it doesn't need to be on the same machine, anything it can see. And you can map that service into Service Bus with that tool, and that makes an endpoint that the agent can talk to, and the agent will then expose on a port that you could choose the client. So that happens through some config. So you have a host mapping. Go make that a little bigger. You have a host mapping here in Portbridge that's on the server side. So you map a target host, so in this case it's localhost, and you say which are the allowed ports you can go to. So there's a firewalling capability, if you will. And you can have any target host, and that target host gets projected in, and then on the client side, you have the agent, and that now maps a local TCP port, in this case 13,389, to a target host on the remote TCP port. So that's the port you want to go to. And then, oops, sorry, ooh la la, I pushed the wrong button. And then you can, to avoid abuse, there's a firewall rule built into that thing so that you will control who can connect to that port that you just opened. So you can constrain connections to that local port that you just opened that represents the other machine to the local machine. So there's special firewalling that the app itself has around that. So and with this, you can basically just pull any port from any machine together on a single machine and just talk to them. That code is, I'm not going to run this, but it's very easy for you to run that yourself. Has all the code here, download it, and you can go and compile it, and you can go and own it, and it's just a sample, right? And this is all built on top of the thing that I just showed you. This is built on top of the NetTCP relay binding. The data packets, the binary data packets, are using the SOAP messages of NetTCP as the TCP frames. Now you'll say, wait, that's a lot of overhead because it's SOAP. It's not, because NetTCP is using the net binary format, and the net binary format is a super efficient encoding of XML, where the entirety of a SOAP package with all the stuff that's in there, envelope and headers and all this stuff, shrinks down to 43 bytes. And 43 bytes is overhead that is actually quite nice. PortBridge defaults to, has a nagling algorithm that's packing data as good as it can into packets, and it's nagling up to 48K. So you make the, you do the math of what 48K and 43 bytes means in terms of percentage overhead. It's not a lot. So that's the tunneling thing that we have. So you find that through PortBridge in my name. And now to the new stuff. I have 13 minutes to talk about it, which I'm glad because I can't divulge too many secrets in that time. So queues. Queues are new. Queues are brand new. We will present them for the first time at TechEd, so this is a glimpse into the future. We currently have the message buffer. The message buffer is in memory, 10 minutes, 2 megabytes capacity, 60K. It's volatile. There's no guarantees when you put a message in that we do anything particular with it. We may lose it. That's the current state of affairs. And it's a targeted scenario, mostly for online, offline scenarios. So it's not a real queue yet. That's why it's called message buffer. The new thing is going to be called the queue. Durable, no lifetime limit. It's going to have a capacity of 100 megabytes or more. You'll be eventually be able to set that, and the message size is 256K. And it's going to speak a number of protocols. Most notably, it has a REST HTTP head. The REST head supports long polling. So unlike the Azure queue or many other queues, you don't have to walk up to that queuing service and then get a there's nothing here request back. But you can park a request using the timeout parameter for up to 120 seconds, practically up to 60 seconds, because most of the infrastructure on the way is going to cut you off otherwise. So, but you can park a request for 60 seconds. We're just going to keep that socket open and entertained. As soon as a message arrives for you, we'll unblock and send you that message. And otherwise, you have much less round-trip traffic. I mean, if you do it 60 seconds, then you're going to do 60 requests an hour, and that's not a lot. So the same protocol will apply to the queue and also to the new topics. And then we have a protocol that we're working on. So we have a protocol we're going to have that's TCP and SOAP-based, and we have a protocol that we're working on with other parts of the industry that will eventually support there too. Why would you want to use queues? Well, very simply, one of them is load leveling. You have a lot of spiky traffic that comes into your website, and you want to go and flatten that out so you have predictable traffic for the back end. So that's one common use for the queue, where you have unpredictable or very spiky traffic, but you don't want to have the spikiness coming through to the entire system. So you put a queue in the middle that decouples those things and turns this into a push-pull. So you perform a push-pull translation with the queue, and with that you can go and level out the load. That's the first reason why you want to use a queue. The second is load balancing. You have a job, the job comes in, and now you want to go and balance that job. So you have a number of competing consumers. The competing consumers all sit there, they're all workers, and those workers can now grab jobs from the queue as they have capacity available. So you don't load balance by push, but you load balance by pull, and with that, you get automatic, you get automatic intelligence about how many machines do I need, because the queue shrinks and grows. As the queue grows, you need more workers. As the queue shrinks, you need less workers. And you never overtax one of the consumers, because the consumers pull their own data. So that's another great reason to have a queue. And then temporal decoupling. If the consumer is fast asleep, you can go and still send work to that consumer or still send information to that consumer, and the queue is just going to hold that for the consumer until the consumer wakes up. And it also is good for scheduled batch processing. Right? In very many cases, you have systems where you have ample capacity that just sits around at a certain point in time, but you don't want to go and open the floodgates just yet. Right? It's plenty if you do some work sometime during the day, probably during night. So you just accumulate work in your system in a queue, and then at some point in time, you just let the system go. So, for instance, in Windows Azure, what you could do is you could have a job that's external or even sitting in Windows Azure, where you just accumulate data that sits in the queue. You then measure the size of the queue, and then you say, okay, at 11 at night, I'm going to provision N VMs, right? So I'm automatically going to go and scale a deployment up to as many machines as I need, push the button, let's go, and they start processing those machines. And once the queue is empty, you wrap it all up and put it on the side again until the next day. Because you don't have to have those machines deployed all the time. You can fully automate that process, so that's something they can do really well with queues, where you just pile up the work, and then you process that work, and you just have a small time window when you need to have those compute instances there, instead of having those compute instances there all the time. Great advantage of cloud computing, just to have that elasticity, because all of those things are completely automatable. And of course, integrity. You have a worker, and the worker takes a job, and now the worker burns up. Because the queue is supporting a protocol called Peaklok and will also support transaction integration, that's not a problem. Because we are able, you take a job, and if you Peaklok it, which means you get a copy of that message, the message is locked for you, but it still remains in the queue. You take it, you work on that job. Only if that job is complete, you tell the queue to delete the message, and otherwise, the lock will, if you just go away, the lock will expire and the message reappears. So it adds resiliency to your system as well. So queues are enormously useful in most of those environments, and we built that queue with all these capabilities to allow you to do all this. So practical way of doing this, and I would urge you, not only, this is not only a talk about our queue that we're bringing out, but this is also talk about MSMQ. We own MSMQ as well. So if you're building web systems or HTTP systems and you're not using a queue yet, I would seriously urge you to take a look at it, because it's really useful. So here's an example of how a queue can be useful. In this case, you have an ASP.NET front end, and you have work that needs to be done. And it's request reply work. Right? It's not one-way throwaway work, blah, blah, blah. It's really a request reply. And you have back-end workers that need to get that work done. But you get a lot of spiky traffic up here, and you do want to drive all that spiky traffic down to the back-end. You have a limited capacity back-end, and you want to keep it that way. You don't want to go and overstress it. So what you do is you have on the ASP.NET front-end, you have a thread, and that thread now goes and pushes a message into that shared worker queue. That thread now gets a wait, and the wait is on a reply queue. So every ASP.NET front end has a reply queue associated with it, right? So now message gets sent. In the message, in the reply queue property, I say, if you have a reply for me, send that to the following queue. And by the way, the message ID is the following message ID. So I sent that message in. Now a worker picks that up and works on it. Meanwhile, I wait on the front and I say, receive by correlation ID for a set period of time. Let's say 5 seconds, 2 seconds on that reply queue. The worker now gets the job, works on the job, sees the reply queue, throws it into the reply queue, with the message ID of the incoming message becoming the correlation ID, and throws that in there. If that happens within the time, the allocated time, it's all good. The message is arriving by the correlation ID, it get it out, you have the reply, you throw it back to the requester. Wonderful, running through the queue. If the timeout expires, right, which is also possible, you return to the user and say, sorry, it's going to take a little bit of time. And then you move the reply by the work, because nobody's going to ask for that message, right? It's all by correlation ID. You can then go and drain that queue and take all these jobs which haven't been fetched and notify the user in some other way. So you have a very clean way of decoupling those things. But what that causes is that you never overstress the back-end system by decoupling it through a queue, but you can also make that work in a request reply fashion, which is very cool. So we will have a queuing system like that, and I'm going to just tease it. So there will be a service bus namespace client that you can create, and I'm just not going to make that, and you can, on that namespace client, you can go and create a queue and a topic. Then there's going to be a messaging factory. That you can create. I'm not going to fill that out, right? On the factory, you can actually go and create your clients, or client for a subscription, or client for a topic, and then work with those and go send stuff to queues. But I'm not showing that today. So last thing, 2 minutes, two and a half minutes, topics. Topics are super queues, or the other way around, queues are degenerated topics. So a topic is a log, and each subscriber, you can create subscriptions, named subscriptions, has its own view on that log, and has its own cursor that it runs over with that log, and can have a set of rules associated with it that you can go and filter on. So you can say, you can have on the messages, you can have properties that you can promote out of your data, let's say customer name, and then you have multiple subscriptions per partition of your system. You have a subscription, you can have a rule on that subscription that says customer name like, it's a SQL expression, like V percentage. So all the messages that come down for customers that start with V come down on that subscription. And you have another subscription that goes to another partition that is for everybody who starts with M. So you can go throw messages in, and you can do the partitioning through the topic. So that's one thing you can do. You can go and fan out events to all kinds of different consumers. You'll notice there's a subscription, and here's a single consumer, but you can also have competing consumers on the subscription. So the subscription acts like a queue. In fact, a queue is nothing but a topic with a single subscription with no rule with competing consumers. And then another thing you can do with topics, and that's really cool, and we predict that most people will use topics all the time, is instead of queues, is that you can always add a tab. So you have a thing that behaves like a queue in the key case, right? So you have a subscription and competing consumers, and you add a second subscription that catches all messages, where you can have an audit subscriber that basically just gets all the original messages and writes them away. So the topic is more powerful than the queue because it always allows you to add an additional tab for all kinds of purposes. So that's going to be there. So the community technology preview coming in May within the next 3 weeks will have topics and queues. I encourage you to watch the video that's going to come out of TechEd where I'm going to be presenting the API. We're going to have some more things. I think we're going to shoot some additional videos that you can go and look at, which is going to explain all those features. It's really exciting. We have a lot of stuff, as you've seen, in connectivity already. This was the last time probably that within a single session we'll be covering messaging and connectivity in this way with such depth for connectivity, because that is a vast, broad area that will get a lot of coverage, and that's propelling Service Bus kind of into being a next generation, really Service Bus messaging infrastructure that's going to be the basis for a lot of things. And don't forget, it's all for appliance, box, and cloud. So this is all coming down to the server within the next 18 months or so. So it's not only for Windows Azure. And of course, Service Bus is useful for connecting apps irrespective of whether they're hosted in Azure. So you can use that for interconnecting apps today, because very many applications today have internet dependency. So you can just put a namespace into the Amsterdam data center and just make that part of your infrastructure, right? But we're also coming down with Service Bus into the server. And that's what I had. If you have questions, feel free to tweet me at Clemens V, or come up to me here after the talk. And otherwise, Twitter's a good way. Or I'm also Clemens V at Microsoft.com. And with that, thank you for your attention.